You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
We have one more FQXI member to congratulate. It's writer Peter Byrne, who has won a gold award in the 2016 Kavli Science Journalism Awards, one of the most prestigious prizes in science writing. He was recognized for a series of newspaper articles for the Point Reyes Light in California, in which he looked at an alleged breast cancer epidemic in upscale Marin County. Byrne found that widespread cancer screening, producing many false positives, was the likely cause of a feared cancer cluster in the county.
Byrne has also chatted with us on the podcast a number of times, usually in his capacity as biographer of Hugh Everett III, the father of the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics. But he also attended FQXI's meeting in Banff to talk about the topic of his latest book on scientific efforts to understand and combat terrorism. I chatted with him at the meeting, where he explained why this issue raises a foundational question about the act of observation.
Well, the name of my talk was The Science of ISIS. And basically, it's about how theoretical sciences are used by intelligence agencies and in their private sector contractors and by the military to try and model terrorist groups so that they can make predictions about their behavior. The reason it fit into this Foundational Questions conference is because the theme of this conference is who is the observer? And it turns out that defining terrorism is much more difficult than people ordinarily believe because it is really a perspectival issue. It depends on who you are as an observer of, say, a terrorist act, whether or not you consider it to be terrorism. The cliche is that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, but actually psychologists have been studying terrorists for decades in the modern era, and one of the takeaway lessons is that terrorists are considered by psychologists to be rational actors, given their beliefs. Their actions where they attack civilians who are generally targets that are standing in for more fundamental institutional targets like governments or corporations or entities that they can't actually attack directly, that these rational actors are acting in accord with a reasoned analysis of what their situation is. So from their observation, they're not committing acts of terrorism. In fact, peoples whose families are blown up by drones that are sent to attack terrorists in Afghanistan, suspected terrorists in Afghanistan or Iraq, consider the drones to be acts of terrorism. So that's how it fit into the conference. And what I talked about was how physics and evolutionary biology and psychology and network theory and just a whole range of theoretical sciences are now and have been for the last 15 or so years deployed to try and make these predictive models with very little success in one way and with some success in another way.
Well, that's just what I was going to ask you. So you're looking at this from very much the scientific perspective, but how useful has that been over the years? Or maybe another way of asking it is, could it have been more successful if some of this science had been taken more seriously earlier?
Well, there's two points to make here. One, in answer to your second point, is that unfortunately, even though the United States government has spent literally hundreds of billions of dollars commissioning studies by probably thousands of scientists to try and build these models, they pretty much don't listen to the results. And I'll give you an example. Using Twitter stream analysis, which there's a lot of social media type algorithms and methods by which Twitter streams and Facebooks and other social media are analyzed. Using that kind of analysis, scientists looked at the content of the Twitter stream from Iraq and Syria before the United States and its allies started bombing ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. And the Twitter stream from the jihadist camp identified the enemy as what they call the near enemy. That would be the local imams and mayors and maybe the Saudi nobility. And once the bomb started falling, the Twitter stream flipped over to identifying the enemy as the far enemy, which would be the Western powers. And following that, there was all these ISIS-inspired or ISIS-concocted and supervised attacks in Paris and Brussels and Orlando and San Bernardino and other places. And that was a kind of a retrodictive method where you looked at what the because the Twitter stream is gobbled up and kept, you know, a record of it is kept, which you have to buy from, like, Twitter. But by looking at it retrodictively, you can make up methods by which you might be able to look at it predictively, so that since the Twitter stream can be analyzed in real time, and a number of people have been working on this, if you see a bump in the talk about who the targets should be, or and actually even the linguistic terms that are used in the Twitter stream, there have been studies that showed that the complexity of the use of language in Twitter streams in intercept the jihadist communications, or even in their public communications, gets much simpler right prior to an attack. So there's some predictive value and success, actually, I have to say, in predicting that there will be an attack, but that's different than saying where it will be or how it will happen. Nonetheless, it's valuable information. Unfortunately, the scientists have been telling the powers that be for many years now that the worst possible thing you can do to a group like ISIS, because there's, you know, been groups more or less like that in the past and there probably will be in the future, that the worst possible thing you can do is to do things like bomb them and kick the hornet's nest, as it were, because they're extremely adaptive, resilient, robust networks. And the term now we use is anti-fragile, which means that an attack can actually make a network stronger because it adapts and learns how to respond. The scientists have actually been telling, and I use that term broadly, the agencies that are in charge of counterterrorism that the best thing to do with a group like ISIS would be to isolate it and let it devolve on its own. You know, you can do things like limit the amount of ability of for it to gather funds from abroad or foreign recruits from abroad. But, you know, frankly, if you let ISIS set up its own state and to run it, it clearly will assume the responsibilities of a state and have to act like a state, and we've seen some evidence of that. And that makes it no longer a terrorist group, per se. There's no definition that fits that. And it brings into play a lot of different kinds of constraints, like they have to enter into trade with entities outside of it. And if they repress their own populations too much, people will rebel or they'll kill everybody and they won't have a population to tax. So, you know, there's a huge logical argument to be made for containing terrorism rather than attacking it directly. And certainly we can see from what's been happening over the past 15 years that attacking it directly is a formula for failure that benefits only the corporations that sell the weaponry that is being used.
Let me take you back a bit. You were talking about, you know, analysis of sort of Twitter streams to kind of predict what might happen and how you can see it kind of change in sort of the language that's being used prior to an attack. I'm just wondering what sort of things can be done in response to that? Because I guess one of the worries is issues about overly policing innocent people.
Well, you basically just described what is being done. That's the status quo. Unfortunately, there is no strategic plan by the United States or any of the European governments to address this issue. It's all kind of a ad hoc, politically based, fear-motivated, money-driven system.
So let's talk a bit about the book that you're working on. It's called The Science of ISIS. Which types of scientists are you speaking to specifically, and what exactly are they doing? You gave the example of people who are kind of analyzing Twitter streams, but what kind of science is being done?
Well, it's really wide-ranging. I think there's about 20 or two dozen different scientific disciplines involved. I mean, evolutionary biology, for instance, is deep into it because, you know, in evolutionary biology, you look at stresses on a system and see how kind of alternative realities branch off from one another and how systems adapt. Network theory, computation is very much involved. For instance, identifying nodes in a network diagram of a terrorist group or a collection of terrorist groups enables you, in theory, to identify who the leaders might be or the power centers. And the United States has adapted this tactic of what they call decapitation, which is to try and identify nodes and then take them out with drone strikes. But it hasn't worked. networks are so resilient that the leaders are replaced very quickly. The networks can disperse, they can relocate, they can cause terrorist acts to happen thousands of miles away that divert the resources away from attacking the terrorists on the ground where they are trying to establish a state, for instance. So there's that. There's anthropology has been used a great deal. Unfortunately, it's been used very badly. Around the time of the surge in 2008, the military hired a lot of anthropologists. They called them human terrain specialists. And they went to Iraq and went with SEAL teams on various missions, some assassinations and some trying to win the so-called hearts and minds of villagers in Afghanistan. And their information was being used by the intelligence community to target who they thought the potential leaders were, the nodes in the communities, which they would then assassinate. And very quickly, the Afghani villagers realized what was going on, and they killed an anthropologist, a woman, which stopped the program dead in its tracks, and then they had to rethink it. And they still want to use anthropology because in a lot of these areas you have tribal formations that have their own interests, and you need to understand what those interests are. And anthropology can be a very valuable tool to do it. But the American Anthropology Association has vehemently objected to the use of that. They say it's like using doctors to be spies, you know. And is there a way to do this without actually turning over actionable intelligence? Probably not.
So I know this is something that you're still working on, but do you have a sense yet of what the kind of the take-home message is or what it is the book is going to try to say?
I think the take-home message from everybody that I've talked to is that violence begets more violence, and that the answer to this problem is alleviating the actual grievances that people have in the Middle East against the Western corporate governments and militaries. And until and unless that's done, this program is going to grow exponentially.
Thanks to Peter Byrne for talking about his latest book, There with Zia. On the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, we are linking to some previous interviews with Byrne about Hugh Everett III and more about his Copley-winning writing.